Greetings. Welcome to In Conversation with Trevor, brought to you by Heart and Soul Broadcasting Services. I go beyond the headlines and beyond the sensational. Today, I'm in conversation with Dr. Chido Ratidzai Rafa Madzamutse, a consultant psychiatrist. This is a painful conversation, but we must have it. Dr. Chido Ratidzai Rafa Madzamutse, welcome to In Conversation with Trevor.
Thank you, Trevor. Thank you for the invitation.
Lots of names. Shall we go through them?
Yes.
Chido, I understand.
Yes.
Why Ratidzai?
Ratidzai was my grandmother's name, my father's mother.
Rafa?
Rafa is my maiden name.
Maiden.
So that's where I came from.
Okay.
Then I married into the Madzamutses.
Wow. I always love getting into those names. Doctor, you have been in private practice as a consultant psychiatrist since 2016. That's quite a long time. And as we were, as I was introducing you here, people don't know that I make lots of mistakes. I made a number of mistakes, and you say, this could be a mental issue. What were you talking about? What were you saying about my mental state?
Anxiety. Anxiety can happen, especially when you're on camera. These are things that are common. Anything that can disturb your ability to reach your full potential, to be productive, to be effective, to make a meaningful contribution, that can be a mental health issue.
So I do have a mental health issue.
Maybe not a diagnosis.
Yeah. So the fact that I'm under pressure, mm-hmm. I'm stressed, mm-hmm. I'm anxious. Mm-hmm. Clearly, I might take this with me home. I might walk around with it. How do I deal with it?
Mm-hmm. So this is where we need a better understanding about what mental health is. Mental health is not psychosis. It's not something as dramatic as that all the time. Many times the common mental health problems are things like stress and burnout and anxiety and depression. Those are what we call the common mental health problems. Yes, sometimes we take our work home with us. Sometimes we let the stresses of the world overwhelm us. And then, we'll be struggling with our mental health. You may not have a diagnosis of a mental health problem, but it just means that we're struggling with our mental health, and we need to learn to acknowledge that. Yeah.
So in your practice since 2016, what kind of common and uncommon mental health issues are you encountering?
So, like I said, the things that are really common, particularly in a private setting, stress and burnout. We see a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety. So this is in contrast to what people imagine when we say mental health or psychiatrist. So I worked in government before as a government psychiatrist. A lot of the times, that's a last port of call, the psychiatric unit. So there you would see psychosis. You would see.
What is psychosis?
Psychosis is a syndrome it's a condition with several symptoms where someone will be struggling with hallucinations, will be struggling with delusions. So they might be experiencing sensations that other people are not experiencing. Not to say that they're not real, because they're real to them, but you can't explain them in terms of the context that they'll be with. So they might see and talk to people. You can't see them. But they're real to that person who's experiencing it. And it can be very frightening. One of my mentors, she's late now, Dr. Nwateo, and she was really the person who inspired me to join psychiatry. She used to say psychosis is painful. Imagine if we're sitting here and you think there are people in this room, you're the only one who can see them. It's actually a painful situation, or maybe you're afraid, you're having a delusion that someone wants to kill you, let's say. It's actually a very scary sensation.
It's real to you.
It's real
to you. But everybody else in the room is not experiencing your reality.
Yes, yeah. So it's actually one of the psychiatric emergencies. There are not many emergencies in psychiatry. I think in terms of this medical discipline. We're not the ones that get woken up at night a lot. Mm-hmm. But this is one of them. Psychosis mm-hmm. is an emergency and it needs to be dealt with, not just from a safety point of view, you know, safety for the individual, safety for others, but in terms of that experience that someone is having that is so frightening and so bewildering. Dr. Niwatua used to always say, it is an emergency. You need to deal with it. It's just like any other form of pain. Yeah.
And the uncommon ones, the uncommon issues that we deal with?
Yeah. So, like I said, psychosis actually is one of the more uncommon ones. There are things like bipolar. I'm sure people have heard about it. It's not as common as, let's say, depression and anxiety. Childhood mental health problems, many of them are not as common. And then, yeah, there's a list of neurodevelopmental things that sometimes we get into, but they're definitely not as common as depression and anxiety and substance uses.
Describe to us what bipolar is, because I think there's a misunderstanding there or complete ignorance. What is bipolar? Okay. How does it manifest itself?
So it's a mood disorder that we now know as a neurological disorder, where there is changes in mood that happen over time. This is not, I wake up feeling happy and then by the evening I'm feeling sad. It's not that rapid. These are changes over many months. So normal human mood is not flat. So we all have, you know, ups and downs. That's normal, actually, for life. But the people...
So if I get up in the morning mm-hmm. and I'm energetic and I'm lively and I'm feeling happy, mm-hmm. And by the end of the day I'm drained and I'm feeling low and slightly depressed, that's mm-hmm. normal?
Well, it's not normal, but it's not bipolar either.
Okay.
So you could be probably overworked and burnt out, but not bipolar.
Okay.
So bipolar is actually quite a serious condition where those mood fluctuations are extreme. So where you would feel a bit low for a few hours or a few days, someone with bipolar would be low for months at a time mm-hmm. and quite a deep depression that they would be in. And then they can then, after maybe a season of that sadness, then move into a pathological happiness, let's say. Yeah, so it's joy that's a little bit above what we think is normal, and we call that, initially we call it hypomania, then it goes into full-blown mania. And mania basically is, I wouldn't be sleeping, I don't need to sleep, I'm very energetic, getting lots of things done. In the hypomanic phase, by the time you get to manic phase, you're not really getting anything done because you can't focus on anything. And then this is the time where delusions might come in, hallucinations might come in, that are very... they're linked to the mood. So I'm feeling very happy, so I'll be a bit grandiose, I'll be a bit over the top. So yes, it is an abnormality, not very common, but when it's there, it needs to be treated because it can really, really affect this ability for someone to be a productive member of society, which is the definition of mental health. So mental health, by definition, is a state of well-being where you can reach your full potential, you can overcome stress, you can deal with the stress of life, you are working productively and effectively, and you are making a meaningful contribution to your family, to your community. That's actually the definition of mental health. So these conditions, once it starts to affect that ability, it needs to be managed. Not so that we just have the joy of managing it, no, but for someone to become that person who's reaching their full potential and is contributing to our community.
But I want us to zero in on certain specific conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And you walk us through them in terms of when are the red lights.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I said, you know, I come in the morning, I'm excited.
Mm-hmm.
I work by the end of the day, I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. you know, it's been a long day, I'm tired and so forth. It's burnout.
Mm-hmm.
But when should I be
worried?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll start with stress. So stress in itself is not a bad word. I think when people say stress, they think it's a pathology in and of itself. It's actually not. So stress is part of life. In fact, we need a little bit of stress to get us up in the morning, all of us. Yeah. But stress needs to be, it needs to be managed well. And also there needs to be an adequate amount of stress that I can manage. So I've got the capacity to manage. So if I've now got stress that's coming at me that I have no capacity to manage anymore, whether it's because there's too much stress or my capacity has been diminished by one reason or another, then I'm overstressed. Once I'm overstressed, we start to get some of these symptoms of irritability and, you know, you come to work, you feel a bit tired, you can't sleep properly. Mild symptoms, but it's starting to show that I'm not coping very well. And if you continue along that path, so if you don't change anything, so either you are not changing in terms of building up your own capacity to deal with stress or not changing the amount of stress coming at you, you can then fall into burnout, which is really the result of a lot of stress that hasn't been managed well for a long time. And burnout itself is they call it a workplace syndrome. But I think it can happen even in the home, which is a workplace, if you think about it. and there are three major symptoms of burnout. One is that change in mood. So you get the irritability. Yeah, just not being able to withstand a lot anymore. So what you could do in the past, you could work an 8, 10, 12-hour day. Now, all of a sudden, by 6, 7 hours, you are done. Yeah, and you're becoming ineffective. That's the other symptoms. So what you could do well, you're not doing well anymore. So there's that ineffective part of it as well. And then there's also the change in attitude. So the cynicism. So when you find yourself becoming a cynic and becoming negative towards life, towards what you're doing, towards people that you work with as well, those are things to pick up and say something is wrong. So, and these are very early things. Burnout is not really a mental health syndrome per se. It's a lifestyle thing that way we address lifestyle issues. But these are early symptoms that you can deal with very early before you then go into deeper issues like depression or anxiety. Yeah.
So there's I like your demarcation of home and work.
Mm-hmm.
What are the work-related mental health issues that we need to be alive to, and the home-related ones that we need to be alive to?
It's interesting, and which made me think that the home is a workplace
as
well.
It is indeed.
So there might not be a very clear distinction here. It is just the human condition and the things that affect human beings where you find yourself working. Some of the things I think to do with work specifically, obviously, burnout is one of them. I think the WHO has recognized that to say sometimes the workplace, there are factors at the workplace that can then increase the risk of getting burnt out. And part of it is, you know, a sense of autonomy, a sense of knowing how your day will end. Jobs where you don't know how the day will end or you have no control over your schedule can really increase your risk of burnout, where you feel like you don't have much control over what you do. Sometimes being overworked, it's true. I think that's the more common one. But also being underworked is true. So you're employed and you're not really sure what you're supposed to be doing. All of that can lead to burnout, interestingly enough, because when you think someone's being underworked, they are not working too hard. But it can lead to burnout because you're always thinking about it and you're thinking, maybe I should be doing more. So all of those factors, these are work-related factors. Also the job itself. So there's certain workplaces that are very stressful. I'll admit our work as medical doctors, particularly as mental health practitioners, can be very stressful. And you have to be very disciplined that you don't carry your work in your head home. So medical doctors are quite at risk of burnout. But as well as lawyers, as well as teachers, you're feeling stressed and under pressure.
What would be your sort of minimal or best way of dealing with these issues to ensure that they don't get out of hand? What's the best way of maintaining
mental being,
balanced mental being?
Yeah, very good question. So mental well-being has been studied, just like you know, sometimes in medicine, we study what is normal and then what is abnormal.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing with mental health. There is what is normal, what should be, and then, of course, what is abnormal, which is all these conditions. So if we look at mental well-being, which is basically what is normal, what we should be when we're mentally well, there are a couple of factors. I'll pick on a few of them. One is a sense of emotional awareness. So being aware of one's emotions. But that takes a few things. One is a bit of emotional literacy or mental health literacy to know what anxiety actually feels like, that tightness in the stomach. Maybe you can't breathe, your pulse rate is going up. Do you recognize that's anxiety? You know, we've got a very good health anxiety. If you've got a runny nose and scratchy throat, and you're coughing, probably got some sort of a flu, a respiratory bug of some sort. And you take yourself off to the doctor, no problem. You don't even think about it. But if you've got constant tightness in your stomach, you can't breathe, you get these episodes where you get really tense, you can't breathe, you sweat, palpitations, you have to sort of excuse yourself from maybe a meeting or something, and this happens again and again. Do we know what that is as a population, as a people? Do we recognize that, oh, that's anxiety, you're having a panic attack. Have you had a few of those? I think you need to go and talk to your doctor. We don't really think in that fashion. So the first thing is mental health literacy, understanding the symptoms. Even if they're not a syndrome or a condition yet, just to understand that today I had a bad day, I was feeling very anxious. Or today I didn't feel like going to work. Why? Because I was feeling anxious about the day and what was going to happen today. So understanding our own emotions, I think is one of the keys to mental wellness. Because you can't even deal with what is abnormal about that emotion until you know it. So that's mental health literacy, emotional literacy. Once you're aware of them, you also need to be quite authentic as well. So we're very good at, how are you?
I'm fine.
So I'm not saying you tell everybody, Trev, but a few people should know what's really going on. Yeah.
Everybody that asks me, I'm going to stop and say, you know what, I have this tension.
Yeah. So it's and that's the fear that people have to say, am I going to be hanging all of this out in public? Which is, you don't need to do that. You need to have a few trusted people in your life. All of us need a few trusted people who we you know, you call up and you tell them the truth. And that's it requires a level of authenticity, realness.
Vulnerability. We're not very good at that.
Yeah. Because there's fear. There's stigma, hey? There is stigma out there. It's a real problem. I think stigma obviously is linked to understanding. We fear what we don't understand. So if I don't understand what you're talking about, I become fearful of it and I can stigmatize you. And stigma, I mean, we saw it with HIV. And to be honest, I think where mental health is right now is where HIV was maybe 20, 30 years ago. Where just to hear HIV, we'd all get very frightened because we didn't know what it was. But now that we've got a better understanding about what it is and how it's treated, we're not so fearful anymore and we don't stigmatize people as much. But with mental health, we're still far off. Where if I just start to say, I'm not doing okay already, she's not mentally stable. Which is not really.
Is that a cultural issue? Is that just about us? Or is it a black thing? Talk to me about that.
I don't think it's a black thing. Although I think there is more awareness maybe in the Western world about mental health issues. But I don't think it's a human thing. Because we've got clients across the racial divide.
But I'm finding, Doctor, that our kids are okay with saying, I'm not okay.
So the culture is changing because the culture changes. Culture is dynamic. So there are things that are starting to change because they have grown up in a world where it is talked about. Whereas 20 years ago, that wasn't the case. And there are some specific cultural issues that we struggle with. One of them is causation. So how we attribute causation of what is going on. So if I'm having depression, where I'm sad, I'm withdrawn, I don't talk to people, I'm getting demotivated, I'm not as, you know, inspired about life anymore, I'm tired all the time, I'm not eating properly, I'm not sleeping properly. Where in a different culture they might attribute that to, oh, maybe she's a bit depressed. In our culture we might not look at it that way because of our own belief systems, and we might then attribute these symptoms to spiritual issues, to cultural issues.
Arroyo.
I mean, psychosis can be dramatic, right? So you'll be looking at these symptoms, hallucinations, delusions. It's frightening. So you think, what has caused this? Are you sure it's chemical imbalance in the brain? I don't think so. Are you sure this isn't because of, you know, what happened with Uncle XY two generations ago? He killed someone to eat you. Isn't this what is affecting? So there's the issue of causation. So causation will then affect how we deal with the problem. So like I said, many times we're the last port of call. People have tried all sorts of things before they turn to the psychiatrist for help, which we don't mind as long as they eventually come. But, you know, if you could come earlier, things could be dealt with a lot earlier. And in saying this, I'm not discarding the multifaceted nature of mental health problems or health problems in general, because health, we believe, there's biological, psychological, social, spiritual components to health.
Imagine getting free access to the Newsday, the Standard, the Zimbabwe Independent, and the Weekly Digest for a full month. Well, you can, and all you need to do is download the Newsday e-reader app on Google Play Store or scan the Newsday QR code in any of the AMH print publications and start enjoying the quality content. Usasaririrewe, famba ne time, famba ne chokwadi, famba ne e-paper.
So health is multifaceted. Health is not just it's not just biology. It's not just our bodies that are unwell. So there's the biological aspect of health. There's a psychological aspect of health. There's a social cultural aspect of health, and there's a spiritual aspect of health. Then if you look at the WHO definition of health, it actually talks about all those facets. And if you're healthy, you're healthy in all those domains. So when you look at mental health, it's the same. Most conditions, there will be a biological basis to it. There's a lot of research that has been done into psychiatry now. Psychiatry, by the way, is a very young specialty in medicine. Just since the 1950s, that's when the medical practice of psychiatry took off. Before that, not much could have been done because people didn't have the medicines to be able to help people. So there was a lot of observation. This is where the asylums came up. When someone was well, unwell, very well, you'd be put away. But since the 1950s, that has shifted now. So there's a lot of biological things that we now understand, inflammation that can cause certain problems, changes in brain chemistry that can cause certain problems. We understand a lot more about that now. But it's not isolated. So this person who is unwell, who's depressed, who's anxious, is also, they've also got a mind. So they've got their psychological way of looking at the world, you know, their way of looking at life. So if I have got a negative way of looking at life anyway, outside of my other conditions, I will then struggle to get better even if you give me all the pills in the world. So that needs to be addressed as well. Let's say someone with depression, severe depression, they might be given medication, but they also need psychological care so that they can shift certain mindsets that they have and look at life in a different way, in a healthier way. Then, of course, there's the social cultural aspects of things. There are some conditions that are worsened or even caused by social pressures. So burnout being one.
Yeah.
That's social pressures. You're not going to treat burnout with pills. You're going to treat it by addressing the social issues. Talking with someone and saying, well, what needs to change here? We can't continue the way we're going. We're going to get very ill. So why don't we, what do you think? Let's problem solve. Let's try and see how we can solve this problem that you're either feeling overworked or you're feeling drained, with your work. And then, ultimately also the spiritual aspect of it. It's very true that patients who have a faith, do seem to do better. I suppose it's also linked to hope. It's also linked to a sense of purpose as well, which are all aspects of mental well-being as well. So if you look at it that way, you then realize that it's not just the medicines. It's a very multifaceted way of treating
intervention.
Yes,
and you then bring me to where we are as a country. Economic problems. Political problems. This must manifest somewhat in our mental state, in our wellness mentally. Mm-hmm. Are you finding that to be a case? I mean, I'm hearing, I don't know whether you're experiencing these suicides and that kind of stuff. Is this something that you marital abuse and that kind of stuff? Mm-hmm. Are these things that are related to mental issues?
Yeah, so like I said, the individual does not live in isolation, they live in a community. So if a community is stressed for whatever reason, this is going to affect the individuals in that community. Obviously, some individuals are more vulnerable than others. This is where the whole genetic stuff comes in. Maybe I am genetically vulnerable, and then I'm put in a stressful situation. I might break. Whereas someone who has no genetic vulnerability might take a little longer to have challenges. So yes, we don't live in isolation. We live within the community that we stay in, and those pressures can affect us. But you know, when you're looking at, I'll address the issue of the increase in suicides, and something that we definitely need to address. But I want to just go back on the issue of mental well-being, even within a stressful situation. Sure. So the you asked earlier, how do you maintain your mental well-being? Because stress doesn't go away. And stress, we need to deal better with it. Yes, we might need to modify the stress factors. But many times we also need to be able to grow the skill set to be able to deal with it. And one thing that's very, very important is mental flexibility. So a good friend of mine once said, blessed are the flexible, they will not break. So sometimes we're rigid in our thinking, and then we end up struggling. So life generally needs us to have a problem-solving approach, because problems come. Problems come all the time.
Always.
So part of the skill set that we need to learn and teach our children is how to problem-solve. So that you don't then get overwhelmed. Because if you're facing a problem, and most of the time, when whether with depression, anxiety, we also realize that clients will come in, have got real problems. So they've got problems that they are failing to solve. And this is then causing or worsening the symptoms of depression or anxiety and some of the substance use that we see. I've got a problem, I don't know how to solve it. And then I escape to alcohol and substances. So learning to problem solve is actually a life skill that we all need. And then being able to be mentally flexible. So being able to restructure your life, restructure your priorities when need be. We learned that with COVID. So we had...
Did we?
Well, it highlighted a few things. And we were forced to restructure whether we liked it or not. Because this is where we learned... online meetings. I used to hate online meetings.
Yeah, but you raise an important point. I know you're going to go to suicide. We need to deal with that. Because COVID brought out its own issues around mental health.
Yes.
In as much as Cyclone Idaia brought out its own issues around. Look, let's talk about those tragedy kind of issues, unusual circumstances. That we deal with as human beings and how we overcome them, Cyclone Idaia being one and COVID being one, and the issues, the mental health issues that come out of that. Them.
Yeah. So crises happen, and very unexpectedly, I think both of the issues you've mentioned, it wasn't something that we were expecting. So there was no way we could have anticipated it. And our brains like that. We like the ability to anticipate when something's about to happen so that I then prepare. We didn't get that chance in both of those situations. So you're then put into, obviously, a situation where you become very stressed. And we see a lot of acute stress reactions when there's a very life-threatening situation like that. You can get acute stress reactions. You can then get what we call acute stress disorder. So if this reaction, this sort of anxiety, I can't sleep, I'm feeling tense all the time, lasts more, like close to, you know, more than a week, we then say, okay, this is more than just the usual reaction. An acute stress reaction to some extent is normal because if, like some of the people during Cyclone Idaia, you lost the whole family and you're the only member left, we don't expect you to just be normal after a few days.
You wouldn't be normal if you did that.
You wouldn't be. Yeah. So that acute stress reaction is your your mind's way of trying to make sense of what is going on. But obviously, these symptoms, if they persist over a month, we start talking about, is this post-traumatic stress disorder? And it's actually one of the more common mental health problems as well, because life-threatening situations come in various ways. It could come through like a cyclone like that. It could come through an encounter with COVID. Or you've seen your relatives die from COVID. I think we all lost someone that we know during the COVID time. And it can be very frightening. But then when that fear now stays with you, and then you start maybe to avoid certain situations because you're afraid, or you become very tense, very jumpy, and also you start to relive some of those experiences. So we start to say, okay, that might be post-traumatic stress disorder, and that needs treatment. So yes, the traumatic experiences that we have. But I also to highlight with PTSD and post-traumatic stress disorder, car crashes. You know, the recent bus crash that we had, those are traumas. Sometimes people don't always recognize that. So it's not a cyclone only. It's a car crash. It's a bus crash. Sometimes it's witnessing a car crash. So sometimes if you haven't even experienced it yourself, we call it vicarious trauma. You watch on the pictures on social media, you can actually be traumatized by that, or re-traumatized if it's ever happened to you before. So those are things that can trigger mental health problems, and we need to be quite wary of it, and help people.
And this suicide?
Yeah, so suicide...
in this current environment, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So suicide is something that has always been around. Again, very taboo topic, people don't talk about it. But I thank you for highlighting it, because I think we need to put the spotlight on it. Suicide, a lot of the times, is linked to depression. A lot of the times, over 90% of cases, when you actually go backwards and ask the right questions, you'll be like, oh, okay, there was untreated depression here, or poorly treated depression. There are other things that can also predispose someone to suicide, alcohol and substance use. The severe mental health problems like psychosis can also lead to suicide. But a lot of the times, it's untreated depression. And this is where we need to demystify this. Suicide is one of the severe symptoms of depression that's probably been around for a while, and has been treated untreated or poorly treated. And all the symptoms of depression, the sadness, the lack of interest in life, the lack of motivation, as it gets worse, you start to get a feeling of helplessness, a feeling of hopelessness. Hopelessness is one of the key symptoms that's linked to suicide. When someone starts to feel like there's no light at the end of the tunnel, this is when we're now headed towards thoughts like that. Yeah. And then it doesn't start necessarily off as, I want to harm myself. It starts off as passive suicidal thoughts. Oh, I wish I could sleep and not wake up.
Yeah.
Oh, God, may you take me now. You know, it's there in the Bible.
Yes.
Elijah had suicidal thoughts in 1 Kings 19.
Yeah, yeah.
It's there. So these things have been there since time immemorial. It's just sometimes we don't necessarily acknowledge that they're there. Mm. Or we want to believe that something else caused this. Mm. It couldn't just be that someone was depressed. Mm. And then the active suicidal thoughts come after that, where someone then says, maybe I need to end my life. How do I end my life? And then we then have the actual attempts at suicide. Usually there are more attempts before you see a completed suicide. Many times someone would have tried before, whether they talked about it or not. And eventually. So there's so many points at which you can intervene.
Yeah.
It's actually quite frustrating, because there are many points at which we can intervene and save a life. Suicide is an unnecessary death. It's a preventable death, wholly. Unfortunately, it's one of the leading causes of death amongst our young people, 15 to 29.
Wow.
And this is worldwide.
Wow.
Yeah. So we've got a problem, and this is our future. And we need to be able to now put in safeguards to say, when someone is depressed, we need to address it.
Yeah.
We can't, it's not going to go away by itself. Let's try and get help. If you've got a young person in the home and you're suspecting that they are now feeling, you know, a little bit low, try and get them help. If you can't talk to them, get them to someone who can talk to them. Yeah. And then maybe also on that, the issue of how suicides are reported is very, very important.
Okay.
we get a spate of copycat suicides usually after one is reported, depending on how it was
reported.
Really? Yeah. So remember, depression is there. We've got a significant prevalence of depression. Then someone does die by suicide. And then this is, if it's reported in an irresponsible way. So if you are now giving all the details of how this person ended their life. And then I'm sitting here at home and I'm thinking, I'm also feeling a bit low. I'm around the age this person was. You know, I could do it. So we then get copycat suicide.
Wow, I didn't
realize that. Responsible reporting is also part of the public health effort that we can make to prevent suicides. Mm. On top of, you know,
so what would be responsible reporting? Talk to us about that.
So limiting the details of how the actual suicide was done. Yeah. And then also ending a report like that with, if you're feeling like this, please get help. Because it's, so I'm going to read it and then at the end it will be like, okay, I can get help for this. Or at least some way of signposting that this is not the solution. There are other solutions. Yeah. It's not the only solution. Yeah. There are other solutions. So you can actually help to redirect.
Yeah.
Because we don't know the full prevalence of people with suicidal thoughts out there.
Mm.
So when you do report it, it is something that needs to be done in a way that you are aware that there are people who are on the edge and they could easily
tip over. So I think basically I hear the nudge and wink for us is that as far as this show is concerned, we should say at the bottom there, if you have
a challenge,
experience this kind of thing, this is who to get in touch with. And I think it's the right thing to do.
Mm.
I'm reading a lot around mental health issues related to men, the pressures that men face, particularly tough economic conditions like this, but even in a normal society where men are supposed to be men, they are taught that there's no better way of expressing it. You know, you've got to man up.
Mm.
But how do you man up if you're facing real challenges?
Yeah.
Of financial problems, of your own mental stability and that kind of stuff.
Mm.
Talk to us about mental health issues related affecting men.
Thank you so much for highlighting that. I think just this conversation is hopefully going to start conversations about this amongst men. So you're right. I think there's been almost a toxic masculinity profile out there that has been portrayed. And this is portrayed from when boys are very young. So they're almost taught to shut down their emotions. As young, before they can even run, before they can even talk properly, they're already being told, boys don't cry. You're already starting to get this young man to shut down his emotions. He's got that emotional part of him. It's a human emotion. It's a human part. It's a normal part of human beings.
Let them express it.
Yes. So, you know, when your little boy cries, boys don't cry.
Mm.
You know, boys don't do this, boys don't do that. Already starting to get this picture of what the world is out there, which is toxic in many ways. And then the other thing is the value of a man. This was something that, I'm busy trying to put a book together. I've interviewed a couple of men and we're trying to hash it out and try and figure out this whole idea of mental health and what will help, what will truly help men. So I've had a lot of, my eyes have been opened in many ways. And one of the things that, you know, we've been discussing is this idea of, is a man valuable outside of what he can do?
Hmm.
So
that's a big question.
Yeah. So women, by existing, you are valuable. But a boy, as he becomes a man, it's always about what can he do? What has he done? What can he do? And we need to go back to valuing people for existing.
For existing, yeah.
Yeah. So going back and actually just really putting value in young men, in boys, in older men, that you are valuable because you exist, not because of what you can do. Yeah. And it then goes back to the issues of, again, that emotional awareness, allowing men space to be vulnerable, to be able to say, yes, I'm taking care of the family, I'm earning the bread, but I'm struggling. Who can I tell? Who will not judge me? Who will not look you know, down on my weakness in having to open up about this. That I think it's important to get spaces like that. But also beyond the spaces to talk about it, this idea that generally in society, men should not be seen as weak. I think that's a challenge. I don't think courage is the absence of vulnerability. I think you can be courageous and be vulnerable at the same time.
Absolutely.
I'm going to war, but I'm scared.
I'm going to do it scared.
Yes. But I'm acknowledging that I'm scared. And the little boys behind me can also see that, oh, he said he's scared. So he gets scared. Oh, okay. So it's okay to be scared. And it's okay to then try and figure out a way of doing it while you're afraid.
What are the issues that men are dealing with that cause them to be up against the wall as far as mental health issues are concerned?
Yeah. So men, they probably face similar issues to what women face, but they're probably not as expressive about it. So we do have a prevalence of depression that's higher in women than men. There are a few factors to that. Hormonal issues that happen with women that might be linked to predisposing them. But we also have not explored the idea of mental health in men too much, that we don't know, we may not know the full prevalence of depression in men and what it looks like. It does look different. So with men, you might not see tears, but you might see irritability, you might see anger, gender-based violence. You're like, why is this guy so angry? And anger is sometimes one of the symptoms of depression in men. That is misunderstood. So I'm angry at everybody. I'm hitting, you know, everything that is in my way. You know, the little boy in the playground that beats everybody. And then sometimes we even we affirm that. Oh, he's just a boy. He's just being a boy. It's a question you need to ask. Why does he want to harm people?
Yeah. If he's a boy.
Yeah. Yeah. We need to ask those questions and address the mental health issues that might be behind that aggression and behind that that anger. You know, there's a we're going to talk about books later. There's a book I've been reading recently.
Sure, absolutely, share it. We share books all over the place. Yeah.
There's a book called How Can I Get Through to You by Terence Reel. And it talks about the dynamic between women and men and the miscommunication that happens between men and women, and how it's not really even their fault. It's just the society that we've created that tells you women should behave like this and men should behave like that. Then we're trying to form sustainable relationships in a toxic society, which makes it difficult to be able to communicate. But one of the things Terence Reel says in that book, he had traveled to Kenya, I think, to see the Maasai. And he asked... he would have these discussions, the psychologist, he was having these discussions with the Maasai warriors and the elders. And then he asked them, you know, I come from the West and we've got this problem about what is a good warrior. Mm-hmm. Is he tough and aggressive or is he gentle and kind? And, you know, they had a big debate about it. Then one of the oldest men in the group then eventually closed the discussion and he was like, a good warrior knows what to be when.
That's it.
So the aggression is not necessarily a bad thing. If there's a robber outside, I need some aggression from my husband to deal with the robber outside. But then the aggression doesn't help in communication. It doesn't help with bonding with the children. That's where the gentle part comes in. And men are capable of both. And being gentle and kind does not mean you're less of a man than the aggressive man. So I think that this is now the shifts that we need in our thinking so that we raise our boys in a healthy way and they don't grow up thinking that there's only one way to be a man. And that's, you know, part of it is mostly toxic.
These are very big things. Essentially, they talk to how our society is ordered. Mm-hmm. They talk to, when you talk about self-awareness, that's huge. Mm-hmm. A lot of us don't take time to get in touch with ourselves, to understand what it is that what is bothering us. But the whole notion of mental health and our understanding as a society and what we ought to bring to the table as a society to help with understanding mental health, but also to be compassionate, the awareness and that kind. Talk to me about this heavy lifting stuff that you do on a daily basis.
Yeah. So yeah, it the way we live impacts our mental well-being, the way we live. I don't know if you've heard that, well, it's a parable, maybe it happened, I'm not really sure, about the village women and their laundry.
No.
So the women used to go down to the river to do their laundry. I'm sure all of us can sort of imagine that in this country. And it was a poor village, and the women would do their laundry, and then the men would go to work, the women would stay and do their laundry. But the laundry time was communal time. The women would get out of their individual houses, they would have relationships with other women, and it was good.
Mm.
Then some mineral was found, and the village became prosperous. Yeah. And as the village became a bit prosperous, one of the men bought his wife a washing machine, because there was now running water and electricity. It's like, why do you need to go down to the river anymore? Just, we've got a washing machine. And obviously, all the women got washing machines eventually. But what that then did was no one went down to the river to wash their clothes. So eventually the society restructured, but not for the good.
Mm.
So it became nuclear.
Mm.
And we've become nuclear to some extent. Relationships are a big part of mental well-being. And as we become nuclear in our families, we put ourselves at a lot of risk in many ways. So we need to think about the way we live and its impact on our mental well-being, the relationships that we have. We are living now in a very over-connected world. Right now we're talking to millions of people. That was impossible.
Absolutely.
20, 30 years ago. So we're overconnected, and it's got its benefits, but we've become so emotionally disconnected, even in the midst of all this connection now. I've got a sister who stays in Johannesburg. You know, we talk on a daily basis. When we actually see each other, it's as if we're seeing each other all along. The conversation continues. Yeah. I've got another sister in the UK. You know, when she first went to the UK, it was almost impossible to talk to her. Now it's like you just pick up the phone and you talk to her. So we are very much overconnected. We're connected. But are we really emotionally connected anymore? And this is where the real relationships.
And I must point this, that are we connected with ourselves?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you might be connected with everybody else, but do you find time for yourself?
For yourself. And this is where, you know, the quietening yourself enough and putting away the gadgets. And most of these things are distractions anyway. I don't really want to.
They don't add value.
So I'm distracting myself. So I need to put them away, and being able to sit with myself and deal with my own emotions and actually figure out where I'm not okay.
Who am I?
Yeah.
These are tough questions. So this is what I do, doctor, and help me. So I sleep. To me, sleep is important.
Very
so I want you to talk to me, talk to us about how important sleep is. Yeah. So I sleep for 7.5 hours.
Well done.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's a must. I do not negotiate. When I go to bed, I take my gadgets. I walk my gadgets to the next room, and I leave them there.
You've got a bedroom.
Yeah, bedroom for the gadgets. I leave them out there. It's time for me to connect with myself, to sleep, to relax, and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What are the things? Is that a healthy way of living? Mm-hmm. What other things should I be doing to ensure that I'm a normal human being?
Very important, and well done for doing that and modeling that, because I think sometimes we almost we don't put a lot of attention on the important things like sleep. We think that overworking is a virtue. It's not. You know, there should be 7 to 8 hours of sleep for every adult who's working. On a daily basis, the sleep routine that you've talked about. So all of us need our own way of dealing with that.
Put your own regime.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that you get your, you literally teach your body it's time to sleep.
Yeah.
it's time to switch down, to slow down and switch off. We're naturally made to do that. So as the sun goes down, we start to produce melatonin. There's less light in our eyes, and the brain has a switch to, say, produce melatonin, which is a sleep hormone, and a few other things. And then you actually slow down, and a few hours later, you should be sleeping. But now we live in a life, a time where we can keep the lights on the whole night if we want. If you think about Kumusha in the rural areas, when we used to visit when we were younger, you would sleep out of necessity because there would be nothing else to do. So the sun goes down, there's no TV, you talk a few stories, and then you go to bed. So people would sleep earlier, generally, and they'll sleep longer.
And sleep, your body gets time to heal, isn't it?
It's physical, it's psychological. There's the physical healing, which is the antioxidants that are dealing with all your torn muscles or whatever issues have been going on in your body during the day. But psychologically as well, this is how you process stress. Your brain doesn't sleep. Your body sleeps. So your brain will be processing stuff. And you need to give it that time. And when you have short bursts of sleep, you don't get that deep sleep that allows you to then get into the rapid eye movement sleep that allows for the psychological healing that actually goes on with sleep. The gadgets, we need discipline, like you're saying. It's easier for us who maybe grew up without them to some extent because we know a life without them. But the younger people, the young adults, the children, they have lived their whole life with gadgets. And we can't take them away because they're now part of life.
Yeah.
But we need to be able to give our kids skill sets to say, this is a good tool. But it can be something that can damage you. So you need to give your gadgets a bedroom or even have a gadget box in the house where everybody drops their gadgets.
Throw them away.
Yeah.
There's something that I'm pretty passionate about. And in our conversation with Thembani Mhambi, I mentioned it. And that is, since reading the book, The Road Less Traveled, I believe that each one of us should have a therapist. That we should at least see a therapist, if not twice a year, but we must see a therapist because we are all broken. Dealing with something, and we need to have the courage or the vulnerability to go and sit with somebody and saying, "I'm not okay."
I think that is ideal. I think that if I could control the things in this world, I would have it that way. But obviously, it might not be always feasible. But so I agree with you, definitely. If you can see a professional counselor or therapist, make do so.
Yeah.
And try and just figure yourself out. You know, the questions about purpose, who am I? The questions about perspective, am I seeing things right? Do I need to be more flexible? Do I need to restructure? Those things are easier when you're bouncing them off someone who's obviously trained to be able to help you think through things.
Yeah.
One of the things that we can do as a community, though, is generally to become more open to conversations. I think, there was a tragedy that happened in our family, and I've actually seen us become more open. So we now actually talk more about feelings and talk more about how people are processing things. But that was because of a tragedy, you see. And I don't think it should come to that there should be a tragedy before we realize the importance of acknowledging our emotions. So conversations within homes, conversations,
the inconvenient conversations,
yes.
The painful ones.
Painful ones. And where you might need to improve our skill sets a little bit, even if it's as lay people, you can improve your skill sets to be able to talk to another person in a productive way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, ideally, if you can get yourself to a therapist, please do.
But
if,
you say there's 17 of you around.
So
17.
Yes.
Therapists, psychiatrists in this country. Sorry, 17 psychiatrists in this country.
Yeah.
So, talk to me about the state of mental health services, the infrastructure, the talent that we have. I mean, 17 of you are not good enough for 16 million of us. Talk to me about that.
So yes, the ratio of psychiatrists to population in this country is not ideal, but we're not alone. If you actually look. Almost all of sub-Saharan Africa, it's the same. Maybe,
but it doesn't make it right.
It doesn't make it right. Yeah, South Africa might be doing a little bit better than everybody else, but all the rest, it's a very, very small population of mental health specialists. We probably have more mental health nurses now, which is a good thing because mental health nurses can help a lot in terms of the structure of a mental health system. So the limited human resources, but very, very passionate, I will tell you that.
Look at your passion. I mean, we're experiencing your passion since you came in here.
Not just me, but I think each of my colleagues, if they were to come in here, they would have the same passion. People who really love people, who love the work that they do. But obviously, multiplying ourselves is proving a bit difficult. So one is obviously to keep encouraging training. The wonderful thing is we train our own psychiatrists. That's not the same in a lot of sub-Saharan African countries where they don't even train their own psychiatrists. Imagine they have to go to other countries to train. So we can just really push. Part of it is making the practice of psychiatry something interesting so that our young doctors look at it and say, I think I want to do that. And I think that is starting to happen because we are becoming a little bit more vocal. They can see us. You know, we used to be in the annex in Harare Psychiatric in Ingucheni, and you didn't even know we existed.
And we thought you were a bit crazy.
We thought, yes, the stigma.
Interesting that you say we've got to make it interesting so that the young people get a sense that it's something worth doing. Mm-hmm. How did you get into it yourself? Let's talk about Dr. Rafa now. How did you get into it yourself?
So we do psychiatry in fourth year in this country when we're training. And I think first and second year, I joined medicine. I was a precocious child. I probably decided I wanted to be a doctor, I think around age 8. Partly influenced by my mom, she's a nurse, nurse midwife. And partly influenced by, we used to watch a lot of, you know, television and come in and we used to see all these emergency medical series. And I was like, I think I want to do that. So it was a challenge as well to say I want to do something difficult. And got into medical school.
University of Zimbabwe.
University of Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. And it was not easy. I think I got through by the grace of God, to be honest. It was not an easy journey.
Why was it not easy?
It's a difficult course.
Okay.
And you come there with your 15 points and then you basically realize your 15 points are not good enough. And here you read a lot of things. You have to,
6 years?
Eventually it was 6 years for us, yes. There were a few delays, so it was 6 years. There was, what's the syllabus? The human body. Sort of syllabus.
Wow.
So it was tough. I found it quite difficult and you know, God got me through it. But around, I think it was third year. Fourth year, actually, just before the psychiatry rotation, we had experienced something in the family. And we used to see these things in the family as well. In society, generally, you look and you're like, I wonder what's wrong with that person, you know, the one who goes around in the bins. Is it a demon? What is it? And these attitudes that you have as you're growing up. And then I went for my psychiatry rotation and joined Dr. Nwateo's firm. It was the first time I met her. And I was like, so there's a whole world of people dealing with these issues. It was such an eye-opener to me. You know, the annex had been kept so far away from the rest of the hospital that a lot of the people don't even know what happens there. So walked in there, and this was, we were told, you don't wear lab coats here. That intimidates the patients. You are a person here. You try and relate on a personal level to someone. We don't try and do the whole paternalistic thing. We sit down with our patients. So you sit down. The ward round is done sitting down. The patient is there with their relatives many times. And I loved that. I was like, I think I want to do medicine this way. This idea of you communicate, you talk, you have conversations, and you try and solve things beyond the medical. So
your love for it arose from exposure.
Yes.
The more you were exposed to it, the more you
understood,
you liked it.
I liked it. I've had amazing teachers.
And
as well.
You did your first degree, University of Zimbabwe, and then?
Yes. And as soon as I finished, this is when there was a bit of collusion with my mentors. So there was Dr. Nyoto, Dr. Mangezi, and everyone was trying to say, we think you've got a talent for this. Why don't you apply for the master's? So this was when I was an intern. So I'd done my degree. I was now an intern. I interned again at Parinyatwa. I was at Annex for a good 4 months now as an intern. So here I was really realizing, I think I like this. And they could see it as well. So they then encouraged me to apply. I think that particular year they'd had very few applications. Normally after you finish your internship, you're supposed to have a year out in district or as a senior house officer. But they were like, no, I think we're going to apply for an exemption for you. As soon as you finish, you join the psychiatry training program. I was like, fine.
Wow.
So I applied. and got in and started training. I think we had a few bumps along the road, where I think the application, other people didn't understand the exemption. They were like, why is she in there? Why is she in there right now? She's supposed to be at district, but it was all ironed out eventually. And I got to do my training, got to do what I loved. Really, I haven't turned back since.
What is working this space taught you about life?
I think communication.
Mm-hmm.
If nothing, I think we need to learn to be better communicators in life generally.
Mm.
And I think many times when you sit with a family, let's say, or sit with a couple, and when you're now looking from the outside in, you're like, ooh, there's communication, the miscommunication, they're missing each other here. And it's easy when you're outside of it. It's not so easy when you're in it. Yeah. But it has taught me a lot. My poor husband has to read the books I read. Send him a book and say, I think we need to read this one together.
And you read together.
We try.
What does he do?
He's a physiotherapist.
How do we help with raising self awareness mm-hmm. around mental health? What should we be doing?
Yeah, so it starts as an individual, like you talked about. You need to be more aware about your own mental health issues. Mm. I think just a conversation like we've had, we're trying to trigger people to think, am I okay? Am I dealing with life well? Do I need help? Yeah. Then at a family level, one of the things that we can do is allow for that conversation to happen. Allow for emotions.
Mm.
You know, many of our families, they don't allow for emotions.
Mm. Stop crying.
Stop crying. Stop throwing a tantrum. Stop. So we need to have conversations. Yes, maybe you might want to control the situation, but afterwards, always have a debrief and say, oh, I try and do that with my kids because I've got young kids. And after the tantrum, I've got 3 girls, a 9-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 10-monther. So, you know, after the tantrum is over, I always try and go back to them and say, what was that about?
Mm.
Can you tell me what you were feeling? You know, what happened? How can we do this better next time?
Which is not easy to do. I'm saying easy to do. We're not comfortable with expressing how we feel.
Yeah. Let alone talking about it too. Yeah. So it's allowing for spaces like that in our families,
mm-hmm.
because this is, you know, the basis of our communities,
mm-hmm.
and then within the community as mm-hmm. well. So one of the things I've been trying to do is just write articles that give people basic, very basic information and start the conversations at different mm-hmm. levels.
Mm-hmm.
Because we need to have, whether it's in the workplace, these are conversations that need to be had.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a lot of absentism in our workplace. So absentism, I'm not at work. Presentism, I'm here, but I'm not there. And we've got a lot of that. And instead of that becoming a disciplinary issue, that mm-hmm. should become a mental health discussion. How are you doing? You know, are HR departments ready for that, for those conversations? These are discussions that can be had that can actually improve the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And we start to have these awareness about it. You know, mm-hmm. we are so aware about HIV, COVID. Are we aware about emotional problems mm-hmm. people can have that they carry with them mm-hmm. to work? Schools, again, another platform. If it was up to me again, mental health would be a subject that you have to take.
How do you take care of your own mental health, Dr. Rafa?
Yes.
Who takes care of you?
Who takes care of me? So my family. My family is very key. I'm very close to my family. And I try and spend a lot of time with my family so that I'm also grounded. I'm doing all these things, but I come back down to me and the people who know me best, and they know me best. But I also have amongst my colleagues people that I professionally would, if I've got an issue that's bothering me, I'm not afraid to go and sit down with someone and say, you know what, I've got an issue and we need to hash it out and you can help me think it through. And I think our community within mental health allows for that.
Okay.
And I love that we are quite close and people generally are quite compassionate mm-hmm. towards each other.
I'm going to push you on us to go very quickly on mm-hmm. the taboos. What do you call them?
The myths.
The
myths.
The myths.
Yeah.
Can we walk through the myths as quickly? Don't explain them. What are they?
About mental.
Related to mental health.
There are issues about, obviously, cultural things. You know, a lot in our society, the beliefs of Kurewa have been bewitched. Someone has, you know, got it out against me. That's why this is happening. Issues about Ngozi. Like I said, it may or may not be there. But then sometimes some of the symptoms are neglected because we just think, oh, Ingo's, even was there, actually, we need to address and see these symptoms. They need to be, someone can't just live like that. So we need to address that. So some of the cultural issues that are.
And have you picked up this, that, you know, don't help people who are the mental, people who don't look okay, vagabonds or whatever out there, because if you do, it's going to come to you.
So Hakira, it's again a very harmful practice that you are now neglecting a human being. Because we're afraid to catch something. Mental health problems are not transmissible.
Infectious,
yeah, like that. And people need help. But again, stigma is about lack of understanding. If you start to understand what psychosis is, all of a sudden you're like, oh, they need help. Let's try and get them the help that they need. Then there are, you know, some of the challenges are also religious. Yeah, and we've been trying to do work with churches, with church leaders to try and get a better understanding within the church about what, mental health issues. Because sometimes, again, people might not just be stuck with the cultural issue. They might be stuck within the church system before they get to us. So they sort of go to church and they're told to pray more. If you pray more, this should not be happening. Fast and pray. I have no problem fasting and praying. I do as well. But I think we need understanding, so that if you start to see the symptoms, oh, I think I've heard this is depression, and I think okay, let's get some help for that. Yeah.
So, because you do work with pastors and church leaders, is that what is this is all about?
Yes, this is something that I do, and definitely even my colleagues as well try and do, to try and demystify mental health amongst church leaders, because they're an influence within our community. We know that. They are leaders within our community. When they speak, people listen. Yeah. So if we also try and get their buy-in to understand that these conditions exist, these issues exist, and as a church, you're actually part of the health system. Because when I present to a church with a health problem, you also need to identify that, no, this is a health problem, and this we can pray about, or we can pray and let's call
go find treatment.
Treatment as well, while we are praying for you.
Dr. Rafa, this is such an important topic, you know. I'm glad you found the time. I think we've just touched the tip iceberg, of the iceberg. This is where I put you under pressure and say, what books have you read that you want to recommend to our book loving audience? But if you've got a couple that are around mental health, that'd be great. But any books, our viewers love books.
So I've got a few, actually, not necessarily mental health related.
That's fine.
I've already mentioned How Do I Get Through to You by Terence Real, but I'll give the other three. One is Captivating, Discovering a Woman's Soul. Yeah, The Heart of a Woman's Soul by Stacy and John Eldridge. I read this book when I was a medical student. I was sort of coming to faith and coming to understand myself. And it was completely life-changing in my understanding of the value of myself as a woman in this community. And one aspect I learned about in that book was the idea of the helper, and how the word helper in Genesis is a poor translation of what God meant. And the original Hebrew actually says ezekneto, which means lifesaver. And that's what he meant when he created a woman. And he only ever uses that term in reference to himself. So it was a very interesting turn. And I was like,
I haven't read it, but I'll look for it.
It's an amazing book.
Yeah.
And amazing book for young women to read, to realize their own value. And that, that, you know, some of the emotional things we go through, that's who we are. And that's fine. Yeah. So the second book, would be Talking to Strangers.
Oh, yeah.
By
I've read
Malcolm
that one.
Gladwell.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, communication.
Book, yeah.
How we miscommunicate, misread each other. And it can lead to disastrous consequences. And I suppose that's partly
why. It can lead to war.
Yes, it can. Miscommunication. Misunderstanding. Yeah. You say something, I didn't understand it, or the context.
I understand it differently.
Yeah.
Because we see the world not as it is.
That's true.
Yeah.
So that's the second one. And then the third one, since I've mentioned Terence Real already, would be Ikigai The Japanese Secret to a Long and Happy Life.
Mm.
So it goes into why the Japanese are as long living as they are.
Right.
One of the biggest things is community, the way they live. Yeah.
Wow. Dr. Rafa, thank you so much. It's a tough conversation. It's an inconvenient conversation, but a very important one to be had. So thank you so much for creating the time. We 17 of you. Wow. We value you. We value the work that you do. The mental wellness of a nation is hugely important. I get the sense that we're not in a good space, but we don't want to admit that there's something wrong with us as a nation. But anyway, we've started the conversation, I think.
Thank you.
Allow me to turn to our viewers who are all over the world. Thank you for supporting us. Remember, we are a weekly show. We are out on YouTube, 7 a.m. Central African time, every Monday morning. To ensure that you don't miss out on any of these quality conversations, I invite you to click here and subscribe, like and share. We've built a website for you where all our conversations sit. So visit our website. We've also built podcasts for your listening pleasure. We are on all major podcast platforms, including on our website. For your listening pleasure. We read all your comments, all your suggestions. Thank you. Keep them coming. Like, share. Until next time, cheers to you all.